I just need to, it needs to go to judiciary one way or another. I mean, that is the point. And so I would like to entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 281 be referred to the Committee of the Judiciary with a due pass recommendation.
Actually, that's the wrong motion. You need to refer it back to the President's desk for additional referral.
Okay.
That you would recommend.
So, Senator Shields moves to moves Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation
Why don't I try making the motion again?
With this recommendation.
Madam Chair, I move that we refer Senate Bill 281 back to the President's desk for subsequent referral with a due pass recommendation.
That would be the right motion.
Okay. Senator Shields
thanks for your help.
Has asked that we refer this Senate Bill 281 to the President's desk with a due pass recommendation with a referral to the committee, Judiciary Committee.
No.
No, that's not what he
no.
said. And we can't
back
save
to the
it.
President's desk for additional referral. That's up to the President where he sends it.
All right. Senator Shields moves that Senate Bill 281 be referred to the President's desk for additional referral.
Period.
With a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation.
There we go.
Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm just going to say, you know, this is about the medical marijuana program, and that's what we're talking about, and it's about treating it as a medicine, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about adding a condition, but we're also talking about putting the right constraints on the program. And for that reason, I wanted it without referral so that it isn't appearing, and it will appear, that we are supporting the bill as it stands, and I don't, because I think there's some other changes to the medical marijuana program, which this relating clause would allow us to do, to be done in judiciary.
Senator, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Cruz, if you're still inclined, I'd be happy to work on a priority bill with you around this issue, and we can do as Senator Shields suggested, and do a separate bill about this, or I can come when you guys hear this in judiciary, since you're on that, and we can figure it out. But I think your points are valid, and I think Senator Shields' points are valid, so I think we just need to figure out a different path for getting our concerns dealt with at this point.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Knowing that this bill is likely to go to a committee where one of our members sits, I can support the motion from the good Senator Shields and the chair's position.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Monson?
Aye.
Now, before you do that, Madam Chair, just let me say that the member he was talking about is me. I'm on that committee, so my no vote hopefully will send a message.
Yes. Thank you, committee. With that, the motion carries, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 281 and open. Are we ready for
yes,
Senate Bill 548?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 548 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health and Science University. It modifies the circumstances in which a person issued the dental instructor's or dental hygiene instructor's license may practice dentistry. This declares an emergency and is effective on passage. We do have a fiscal and a revenue, and both the revenue is a no revenue, and the fiscal is a minimal fiscal impact.
Jeffrey Stewart and Jenny Ladonik.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Dr. Jeanette Mladenovic, and I serve as Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs for Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 548. As many of you know, OHSU, in collaboration with Portland State University, Oregon State University, and the Oregon University System, is building what has been named the Collaborative Life Sciences Building, or the CLSB. The CLSB is currently under construction on the waterfront in Portland and will house interdisciplinary health and sciences education. In addition, OHSU plans to move its School of Dentistry into the CLSB with instruction beginning in 2014. Because of this forthcoming change, OHSU and the Oregon Dental Association have brought Senate Bill 548 to you today. Senate Bill 548 is, in fact, a technical fix that ensures OHSU dental instructors or faculty are able to avoid licensure challenges as OHSU moves its School of Dentistry facilities from the Markham Hill campus to the South Waterfront and works to expand dental residency programs throughout the state. Currently, when defining the limits of a licensee with respect to OHSU and its dental instructors or faculty, the Oregon Dental Practice Act and ORS Chapter 679 uses the term campus in describing the location reserved for practicing dental instruction. However, that term campus is not defined. This means that interpretation of the statute and in turn the boundary of OHSU's campus is left unclear. OHSU is concerned that this lack of clarity could result in overly restrictive interpretations confining the practice of our dental instructors strictly to the Markham Hill campus. Senate Bill 548 resolves this issue by removing the undefined term campus in existing statute and replacing it with language that is inclusive of all Oregon Health and Science University facilities. This will allow OHSU to move and expand the dental program without the fear of a statutory language that is open to interpretation. Currently, we are concerned that this ambiguity is in the statute may cause an issue for OHSU faculty practicing at the Russell Street Dental Clinic, a public health dental clinic located off the Markham Hill campus in North Portland. Additionally, it is particularly important for us to resolve this issue prior to moving the School of Dentistry to the South Waterfront. Senate Bill 548 is a technical fix that aligns statutory language with the evolving realities of a dental education at OHSU. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I encourage your support for this legislation.
Thank you. And let's have the testimony, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jeff Stewart, and I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. I am both the Speaker of the House for the ODA and a full-time faculty member at the OHSU School of Dentistry. Thank you for allowing me to speak today in support of Senate Bill 548. The Oregon dental community is eagerly anticipating the relocation of the dental school and its programs into the brand new Collaborative Life Sciences Building in Portland's South Waterfront District. This will allow for a place where our dental students can learn and provide patient care in a modern, state-of-the-art facility. The OHSU School of Dentistry plays an important role in fulfilling the oral health care needs of the citizens of Oregon, graduating some of the best clinically trained dentists in the entire region. In addition, the school is a place where the students and faculty are important patient care providers, a nationally recognized dental research facility, and a sponsor for dental continuing education. Senate Bill 548 modifies the current language regarding the dental instructor's license issued by the State Board of Dentistry in order to assure that our current and future dental faculty members who are holders of this license will be able to continue to practice and teach in the new dental school facility in the same manner as they currently function in the existing dental school building. This is crucial In order for our educational and patient care programs to continue at the same high level to which we have become accustomed. We in the dental community are very excited about the move to the new dental school. Significant philanthropic investments from around the dental community were needed to make this new building a possibility. We have the building. Now we need to make sure we have the teachers to make a healthier Oregon a reality. Thank you, and I ask for your support of Senate Bill 548.
Thank you. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Miladinovic, thank you. I have two questions. I'm going to display my ignorance about two things around this. You know, I'm faculty at OHSU, but in the School of Medicine, not the School of Dentistry, and I didn't have to get a separate license to teach there. Why do people who teach dentists have to have separate licenses, but people who teach doctors don't?
It has to do with the licensing laws for dentistry versus medicine. So as you know, I'm a physician also, and we have reciprocity in the dental school, and dental licensure is different. So when we recruit faculty from another dental school, they, even though they've been practicing and teaching in another school, they have to go all the way back and sit for licensure in our state. So this allows faculty who have been faculty elsewhere to become faculty where we are.
Okay, so follow up, and then a second question, Madam Chair.
It's dumb.
Yeah, okay. So why are you asking for this change and not for a change in that law? Because if I were you, I'd be asking for a change in that law and not the rest, and to not make it necessary to have a separate license. If you, the dental school thinks that someone's sufficiently qualified that they want to hire them as faculty, shouldn't that be sufficient to determine whether okay to be an instructor? What am I missing here?
I'll defer that to Dr. Stewart, who's a dentist.
Your question is valid, and as Dr. Mladenovic has already pointed out, the issue is the nature of how dental licenses are issued, but not only in our state, but really across the country, where you apply for a license on a state-by-state basis. So it would we believe that this language is sufficient to provide the clarity that's necessary in the law so that we will be able to recruit faculty from other areas and that they will be able to practice at the school.
So may I, Madam Chair, I don't mean to perseverate on this, but I'm really not trying to be difficult. I'm really trying to understand the difference. I mean, I teach in the dental school sometimes, and I'm always fascinated by the differences in how we teach dentists and how we teach physicians. But is it an Oregon, I mean, in physicians, MDs are licensed state by state, too, to practice. If I want to go practice in Washington, I have to be licensed separately in Washington, separately California, wherever it is I want to practice. So the practice licensure is no different. You have to be licensed separately. But is it a national requirement that dental instructors be licensed separately to teach, or is it a state requirement, and do other states have this requirement as well?
It's a state-by-state issue. It's different in different states. We're very comfortable that we have a dental instructor's license in place. The purpose of this change is only to provide the clarity that we want to have so that when we move from one to the new facility that this license will still
right,
be valid.
Dr. Stewart, forgive me. I understand exactly the purpose of this bill. I just think you're not going as far as I would think you'd want to go. Dr. Mladenovic, can you help me out here? Do you understand
yes,
what I'm asking?
I do understand, Madam Chair and Senator Steiner-Hayward. The difference is that in medical licensure, you very rarely have to go back and take an observed examination. It takes a long time. You have to be observed seeing your work on a patient. In the medical profession, while we apply for licensure, our credentials are verified, and usually that's the extent of it, and then we're given a license. This is a bit different of a process, and so it would require changing the culture of dentistry. That would be my assessment of this.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to I'm fine. If that's fine. If this is the right next step, that's fine, but then this can be a separate conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I don't even remember at this point what my second question was, so I'll just stop now.
Okay. All right. Is there any further discussion? All right. Thank you very much for coming. You're the only two that have signed up. I will close, correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 548. And are you comfortable in going forward? Everyone is?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 548.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 548 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sander-Hewitt?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Motion carries, and Senator Roblin will carry the bill. It is his bill. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 548 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 460.
Okay.
And here you go.
We got a, okay.
And Speaker Cota.
We'll start with the Chair and the Speaker. Madam Speaker, would you like to come up and join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes-Anderson from Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. Delighted to bring before you today Senate Bill 460. And it is a bill to allow for less expensive drugs to be dispensed in Oregon, as well as to keep patients safe while taking these drugs. Senate Bill 460 concerns medicines that are called biologics and biosimilars. Biologics are complex, large molecules that treat serious illnesses such as cancer, multiple sclerosis, and rheumatoid arthritis. A biosimilar is a similar version of an innovative biologic medicine, and this is important. A biosimilar is not generic, the same or identical as the innovator biologic. The bill's basic premise is to create a pathway for biosimilars to be dispensed in Oregon. Currently, there is no statutory authority nor regulatory processes to allow for patients to take these life-saving medicines. In addition, the bill aims to allow for maximum transparency and safety by ensuring that the prescriber, the doctor, the nurse practitioner, etc., is notified after a biosimilar has been dispensed. And I'm sure you have had a lot of people come to talk to you about this bill. And I think that makes, I think as one person said, you may think you're some of the most important people in the building. But it is important to understand what this bill is and what it isn't. And we really need to focus on what the bill actually does, which is simple. This bill allows interchangeable biosimilars to be dispensed by pharmacists. It does that. It's a bill to keep patients safe by ensuring that the prescribing physician knows what the medicine their patients are taking in these very complex, difficult diagnoses. Third, it is filed with amendments. There will be there is an amendment whose goal is to match current law on generics. So this is matching current law on generic prescribing in every way, except for ensuring patients are safe by notifying and prescribing physician after it has been dispensed. So that's the only change, that the provider is notified. This bill is not, this is what it is not. It does not add any impediments to the prescribing of biosimilars. And it is a bill to increase, it is not a bill to increase the cost of drugs. Actually, I see this bill as lowering the cost of drugs by providing a pathway for less expensive biosimilars to be dispensed by pharmacists. Thank you for consideration of this bill, and I would love to have Speaker Kotek give her testimony.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Good to see you today. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of Senate Bill 460. You know, one of the things I really like about being a legislator is you get to learn about all kinds of new things. And I think one of our jobs is to make sure that the laws we have in place and the protections we have in place move with the times. So what you see in this bill is an attempt to anticipate and be ready for introduction of biosimilars on the market. As the center has said, this bill allows for lower-cost biosimilars to be dispensed in Oregon. It ensures patient safety by notifying prescribing physicians after the dispensing. So the person who's getting a biosimilar will know they're getting a biosimilar. It also will match, after the amendment, current generic dispensing practices except for the physician notification. So I think the clarification on the amendment is to make sure we're matching federal law around generics. But let's be clear, biosimilars aren't 100% generics, but they are similar, and we want to make sure we have a process in place to allow them on the market but also protect the individuals who are receiving them. So why do we need to do this now? FDA, actually specifically Janet Woodcock, director of FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, has said in an interview that the FDA plans to approve initial biosimilars without issuing product-specific guidelines for how they should be developed. They could be approved. Biosimilars could be approved as early as next year. So it's important for us to have a consideration of how we would want those products to be on the market. As many of you know, I've worked a lot on trying to lower the cost of healthcare. I don't think this creates barriers for biosimilars to be dispensed or to be on the market. I believe once they are more readily available, there will be a role for biological products and there will be a role for biosimilars. And I think this just allows an opportunity for them to be dispensed in a safe fashion while also aligning with current federal law. So I urge your support. This is a bipartisan bill. There are supporters on both chambers and both parties. It's a common sense bill. I think there's a lot of misinformation being spread about what this bill actually is supposed to do. It's a very simple bill. I urge your eye support and appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Any questions of this panel? I wouldn't dare ask Tina a question. She'd get mad at me.
I'll never get mad at you, Senator Cruz, never. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Next panel, Dr. Tina. Thomas Felix and Dennis McNanny. Please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I had to find my glasses here real quick. Appreciate you taking the time. My name is Dennis McNanny. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Bioscience Association. I'm joined today by Dr. Felix Thomas. I think it's important that I actually read this since I want to get it absolutely correct because the credentials are everything in these sorts of discussions. With me today, Dr. Felix Thomas is the Regulatory Affairs Director at Amgen's Global Regulatory and Safety Organization. Dr. Felix leads the U.S. Regulatory Biosimilar Policy at Amgen and has worked at the company since 2006. He has experience working on both small molecule and large molecule biologics. The scientific differences between these medicines, which will be addressed by Dr. Felix as part of his testimony, serves as the underpinning for the establishment of separate standards and regulatory pathways for approval. Dr. Felix earned his degree from the PSG Institute of Medical Sciences and Research. He will now discuss the substitution policy outlined in Senate Bill 460, and then I'll have some follow-up comments when he concludes his testimony.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of this Senate committee, members of the Senate committee, my name is Dr. Thomas Felix. I'm a regulatory affairs director in our global safety and regulatory organization. We are at Amgen known for developing biotech medications and trying to address grievous illness. We have for a long time committed ourselves for over 32 years and are one of the pioneers in this space. We're leveraging part of that experience to focus on biosimilars and bring them to the market. So it's a new world for us, but it's one that we're committed to making sure is a successful world and done with the appropriate framework in place. I just wanted to, before I dive into some of the content, I've had a chance to speak with some of you. I've had a chance to speak with other representatives and in other states and senators in other states. And I understand that there is a lot of information that is being conveyed to you. There's a lot to try to absorb, digest, understand how it applies to this bill. And I would ask that, you try to keep aside much of the technical nature related to the standards of approval, which are set in stone, and the FDA is moving forward with meeting with companies like ourselves to give us guidance, and really stick to the provisions, which are very simple, as the speaker mentioned. These are simple provisions. There really isn't a lot to cloud the issue. And I think if you do hear something that seems highly technical, I would suggest that you really ask for clarification as to how it specifically impacts the provisions in the bill. With that being said, just to make sure we're all level set, I know you probably have all been talked to by many people, but biosimilars are versions of biologics that are coming off patent, and they are intended to decrease healthcare costs and hopefully increase access to these very expensive medications. Biologics, just to be very clear, are very different than small molecules or traditional pharmaceutical tablet drugs. These are much larger, much more complex. They are not as stable. They have a tendency to, they almost always require cold storage. And if there are changes in handling, if there are changes in manufacturing, they are sensitive to they can affect their stability. So with that in place, realize that the scientific differences have been the reason why there is a federal law in place that has created a pathway for approval of these drugs. It is why the FDA has considered all that is required for approving these with a new paradigm, a new framework in place. And that probably is, it is a higher bar to get a biosimilar approval, and it is an even higher bar to get an interchangeable biosimilar. So that's two tiers of approval that are clearly detailed by the federal law. To underscore the importance of having this passed now, I know that the speaker talked about the arrival of biosimilars as early as 2014. The other thing is to realize that we do not, in the state of Oregon, have laws that address biologic substitution and biologic use. So it's sort of an important need. Right now at this time, there are 14 biosimilars in clinical testing. If you look to clinicaltrials.gov, it's very easy to see which ones are coming to the end of their trial period. And then how we often try to forecast when a biosimilar will be approved is to then think about, there's an application that will soon follow. And then there's a clock of about 12 months that is usually followed after a submission of a biosimilar application that hopefully yields to a decision from the FDA. Let me cover the parts of the bill that everyone seems to agree on, that biosimilars should be substituted if they are interchangeable, which is a designation that's provided by the FDA. I have not heard anybody say that that patients should not be notified. Patients should be notified. So the other part of this is a retention provision, which is to maintain records of this maintain records of the substitution. So the portions of the bill that seem to be most talked about, and you probably have heard an earful, is the patient notification. It seems pretty obvious, so I haven't talked to a single patient or physician group who thinks that there should not be notification of a substitution after the substitution has occurred. And you might hear that somehow the notification is a method to stall uptake of biosimilars. I could understand that if you were thinking about consent from a physician before the substitution actually occurred. You will also hear that there is an undue burden on the pharmacist. And I think this is something that we all need to sort of be vigilant of in healthcare is in a busy practice, are we making sure that we're not asking too much? It's my understanding that there are numerous efforts going on in Oregon in terms of electronic health records. And the concept of notifying a physician shouldn't be the old school way of picking up a phone and taking the time out of your day that can be quite consuming. The idea of creating a mechanism in place that shouldn't be difficult to follow through on, that would be least burdensome on the pharmacist, but still allows that pharmacist to have their given role of substituting drugs that are approved at the state level, would be maintained. The other thing that is a clouded issue is somehow that if you have dispense as written, which is the right of a physician to, on their prescription pad, write dispense as written so substitution cannot occur, physician notification is not needed. And this is, these are two very distinct issues. When a physician writes dispense as written, it's to prevent a substitution, and that's very clear, but we would never have uptake of biosimilars if every physician put dispense as written on their pad. It's intended for use with patients who need special attention, maybe even in a case where they have already been substituted and they've understood that that product is not appropriate for them. This is very different than physician notification, which is intended to create confidence in the medical community so that people know that biosimilars are on the market, they'll be substituted, physicians will be aware of any substitution that occurs, and that the patient's medical record in the physician's office will be updated. There should be no issue of accuracy as it pertains to a patient's medical record that the physician is going to reference as they manage a patient over time. The other thing that I want to also convey is this is not to disparage or to cast biosimilars in a bad light. When the FDA approves these products, it will be with a thorough scientific analysis and with patient safety at heart. The issue is that biologics are complex, and when we say that they're complex, I just want to give you a small example of what we talk about in terms of complexity. A drug like aspirin is 180 Daltons. That's a unit of weight, a measure of weight. If you were to convert that and just think about it in terms of pounds, 180 pounds for aspirin, a monoclonal antibody is 150,000 pounds, 75 tons. So not only is there a difference in weight, but there's a difference in the level of complexity. So we're acknowledging that difference by passing provisions related to physician notification, knowing that these drugs have a tendency, not biosimilar specifically, but all biologic drugs have the potential to evoke an immune response. And sometimes that immune response is in the near term, after they've been administered or had an infusion. Sometimes it takes longer for that response to develop. And it can be up to 9 to 12 months after a drug has been switched. So this is what we're talking about in terms of a physician having the right information at the time of treating a patient so that they're not trying to conduct an investigation, trying to call a pharmacy to make sure. They are going to look to the patient record, and that's what they will believe the patient is on. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? It's a very complex issue. I have read so much on this. It's actually worse than a scope of practice issue as far as I'm concerned. But I would like you to just comment, since the rest of the testimony is going to be negative on this bill, about those that do. We were given a huge list of those who are in favor of the bill, organizations in support of Senate Bill 460. And could you just highlight some of those? Or
I do not have that list. But I can tell you. Sure.
Okay.
It's coming up.
Yeah, we have the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, the American Council of Science and Health, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Bio Association. I mean, there's across the board people who are in support of this, and I just wanted to make sure that the committee, you should have that in your OLIS of the organizations that are...
Not yet.
It's not in OLIS
yet? Yeah, we just got it now.
Oh, we just got it now. Okay.
But it will be.
But it will be, yes.
If I could add also that this is an issue that has been talked about within our industry in much detail. And so there are organizations that serve as umbrella organizations over our industry. One of them is Bio. The second is Pharma. Both of these organizations have voted for these provisions, which means the collective of our industry has voted for these provisions and believe the physician notification is important. So I just wanted to add that as well.
All right. What I would like is I'd like to go through the rest of the testimony, and then Dr. Felix, maybe we can call you back up to clarify some issues.
With the permission of the chair, could I make some additional comments?
Please.
I just wanted to fill in a little bit of the gaps. The Oregon Bioscience Association, as some of you may know, is a rapidly growing organization. We represent 660 companies in the industry here in Oregon. We represent about a $7.1 billion economic footprint in the state. One fact that goes, I think, largely unreported, but we just received a study, nationwide study, comparing all states, and Oregon actually outgrew in employment numbers California, Massachusetts, and Texas from 2001 and 2011. So this is a key driver of the Oregon innovation economy. Wanted to make that point before I made a couple additional points. The first point that I'd like to hit on is that our organization, the Oregon Bioscience Association, took its lead from the national organization and voted as a board to support this initiative, the BioPrinciples. It's outlined in the testimony, so I won't read that word for word. I think it's critical that we, since we're playing a leadership role in innovation, particularly up at OHSU, in the areas of personalized medicine, which is largely driving a lot of the use of biologics, I think it's critical that the physician remain central to this process. And the only only way they can remain central is if they have all of the prescribing data in a single place. My background is as a software person, and I built software IT applications for neurosurgeons. And one of the things we found was the industry was way behind, always realizing there was data they needed to collect, but didn't build their systems to do that. Oregon has the hood up on its Medicaid system right now, and now's the time. If there's ever going to be a use for tracking this sort of granularity in biologic substitutions, now's the time to lead in that effort. So I think it dovetails well with some of the initiatives that are already working their way through the state. I think, lastly, if we are going to remain the center of innovation in this area, I think it's important that doctors, patients, and all stakeholders are brought together and given the same base of information and allowed to be involved with these decisions. So I think the principles of this bill really reflect that, and our organization fully supports the passage of Senate Bill 460.
Well, we're very excited in the state to have new industries come, and I know it was a big boon when Genentech came and located in the Hillsborough area, we do want to be open to any more that want to come to the state.
We're working on those now, as a matter of fact, so more on that later.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right. With that, I'd like to call up those that live far away, and that is Lisa Houchin from the National Association of Chain Drug Stores and Cindy Labacher from Express. I mutilated that from Express Scripts.
Madam Chair and member, Cindy Labacher.
Bacher.
Quite all right. It happens a lot. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name's Cindy Labacher. I'm Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Express Scripts. And we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 460 today. Express Scripts is one of the nation's leading pharmacy benefit management companies. We manage pharmacy benefits for about 109 million Americans, including 170,000 or plus Oregonians. We provide integrated pharmacy benefit management services, including claims processing, home delivery, and specialty benefit management, along with a whole panoply of other things. We appreciate your attention to this issue. For far too long, everyone, Oregonians and Americans generally, have been paying far too much for their biologics, which can run anywhere from $1,000 a treatment to, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. It's a very expensive set of drugs. And these costs are increasing at a rate of about 24% a year, according to our drug trend analysis. So we're here today because we're deeply concerned about the cost implications for our clients and our patients if this bill were to pass. Primarily, when you look across the world, patients are able, in Europe specifically, they enjoy the advantages of biosimilars and seeing their costs, seeing cost savings of upwards anywhere from 10 to 40%. So we, again, think that there's real benefits to when biosimilars become available. The United States took a first step towards making biosimilars a reality in 2010, which you've heard about, through the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act. And since then, the FDA has been working on a pathway, but they're not there yet. They have a lot more work to do, and in fact, there's such a lack of clarity on how the FDA would approve these drugs that no manufacturer has actually submitted an application. In the absence of any applications at the FDA, we believe SB 460 to be premature. Additionally, in attempting to solve for potential market problems that are years away, we believe the bill has incorporated some elements that will cool the market for the eventual market entry of biosimilars at all. By its very consideration, before biosimilars exist in the market, it indicates that biosimilars are somehow substandard or of a lower quality. It creates a paradigm for substitution that is very different from how we treat generic drugs or brand biologics today. The FDA, let's be clear, is not going to approve an unsafe biosimilar. When they approve interchangeable biosimilars, these products by statute will have to have demonstrated repeated switching between the biosimilar and its reference product, that it will not create a risk to the patient. State substitution laws already provide a number of safeguards for patients and physicians in pharmacy substitution. Physicians can direct a pharmacist to dispense the originator or brand product and not fill the prescription with an interchangeable product through the dispenses written, which was talked about earlier. I'll try and cut it short, but basically it's premature for the states to put parameters around substitution of drugs that aren't even in the marketplace yet, and for these reasons we oppose SB 460.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lise Houch, and I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. And I just want to take a minute to let you know who our members are in Oregon. They include Costco, CVS Caremark, Genoa Healthcare, Good Neighbor Pharmacies, Hagen Top Food and Drug, Health Mart Systems, High School Pharmacy, Kmart, Medicine Shop, Omnicare, Rite Aid, Safeway, Shopco, Target, Albertsons, Walgreens, and Walmart. These 17 companies operate over 472 pharmacies in the state of Oregon and wish to convey their serious concerns with Senate Bill 460. We respectfully oppose this legislation as it would impose unnecessary special requirements on the substitution of biosimilar products deemed interchangeable by the FDA. Federal law directs the FDA to develop standards for biosimilars that are appropriately rigorous to protect patient safety. Chain Pharmacy opposes special requirements for the substitution of interchangeable biosimilars that would be inconsistent with federal law and serve only to limit dispensing of biosimilar products. NACDS members oppose the special requirements under Senate Bill 460 for pharmacists to notify prescribers upon substituting biosimilar products deemed interchangeable by the FDA. Imposing any such limitations on the substitution of biosimilars would be inconsistent with the intent of federal law and the standards under development at FDA to implement the BCPI Act. Further, these special requirements would undermine public perception of the safety and efficacy of biosimilar products as compared to other prescription drugs. Creating special practices for the substitution of biosimilars would serve no other purpose than to limit the dispensing of biosimilar products, reducing opportunities to expand patient access to these vital life-saving medications. Barriers to dispensing of biosimilars ultimately impede potential healthcare savings while protecting the profits of innovator biotech firms. As noted in a recent New York Times article, biotech firms, billions at risk, lobby states to limit generics, end quote. Biologic medications account for roughly one quarter of the nation's $320 billion in spending on drugs each year. If enacted, these requirements making the interchange of biosimilars more difficult and therefore less likely will impede greater savings for patients, health insurers, and other third-party payers, including Medicaid, while protecting the profits of innovator biotech firms. Biologic medications represent a growing category of products that on average cost the state Medicaid program $1,563 per prescription and represent 7.4% of the overall drug spend. As less expensive interchangeable biosimilars become approved for use in the United States, we can expect to see significant future health care savings in this area, which Cindy referred to. For the reasons discussed, we respectfully urge you to vote against Senate Bill 460, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you.
I have a question. How many of these biosimilar drugs do you feel will be going through pharmacies? It's my understanding that they need to be refrigerated. A lot of it's infused, and I'm afraid I'd have to have Dr. Felix talk a little bit about the types of medication. Do you feel that there will be a lot of biosimilars coming through your pharmacies?
Chairman Mona Sanderson and committee members, we are Express Scripts is the nation's largest provider of specialty pharmacy. So, and we're the sole provider on a number of specialty drugs, and that's what we're ultimately talking about: are these biologic drugs that are, as you mentioned, infused. The bulk of it, a great deal of it, will go through our specialty pharmacies, in which we have pharmacists and nurses and so on, you know, medical personnel who work with patients on a one-to-one basis to make sure they're getting the right drug, that they're staying adherent to those drugs. So there's systems in place around that. But there are a number of drugs, insulin, for example, and you could at least can address that do go through. They go through mail service pharmacy, they go through community and independent and chain pharmacies. And those are the ones I think that are currently available in Europe. Insulin's one of them. So that there's the potential for diabetics to truly benefit through that and have a mass amount go through the retail chain.
And just to follow up on that, Chair Mona Sanderson and the committee, we have a number of our companies actually run specialty pharmacies as well and are part of, as Cindy was describing, kind of this collaborative care that occurs with the infusion drugs that you're referring to. But a lot of these drugs will actually go, to the best of my knowledge, will actually go through our pharmacies, our retail pharmacies, as you know them as well.
And so the main concern you have then is the prescription, because they're going to be treated exactly like generics. I mean, this legislation doesn't, they should be treated, the process will be just like generics. So the only thing that you feel will be a burden is notifying that provider or the prescriber.
Correct. It's the prescriber notification that is not consistent with what currently occurs in the state as far as when generics are dispensed, nor is it consistent with federal law.
Thank you. Correct. Further questions?
Madam Chair?
Sorry. Yes.
Thank you. But isn't the difference that with generics you're talking about something that is biologically exactly the same compared to this?
There's a chemical. I'll let Cindy. Okay. Cindy probably has more experience with this than I do. Your generics, it is a chemical compound, yes. And there's the difference is this is, you're talking about a biologic. But with the FDA's rigorous approval, the confidence level of the prescriber and the patient will be there prior to FDA approval. So the approval process by the FDA is what will ensure the confidence in the product and its interchangeability.
If I could, Senator Shields, Senator Mona Sanderson, when a brand is made, let's say Lipitor, when they make batch A, and then they make batch B, there's variability. So the batch you got in January of this year is different probably than the ingredient is exactly the same. The amount of the ingredient is exactly the same. But there can be some variability within the brand. And that's true in the generic. There can be a small molecule pill, there can be some variability. That's just that's how the process works. But that's going to be true under biologics. There's biologic Avastin made today is different than Avastin. There can be some variability in that product between when it was manufactured last year and how it's being manufactured today. The basics are all the same. It still has to meet all of the same FDA standards. You have to, you know, safety, purity, efficacy, all of that. And that will be true of biosimilars. As was mentioned, the bar is going to be extremely high for biosimilars to even be approved, much less interchangeable. So that's why we think adding the added level of prescriber notification on top of that just creates this aura of fear around the safety of that drug, and that's our concern with it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming so far. Okay, so let's call up Don Stetcher, Elise Brown, and Carol, is it Chutka?
Chutka.
Please begin.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown here for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and you're in the process of receiving three pieces of information, and the first one I wanted to call your attention to is the flyer that is listed by those in opposition with me at the top, and you'll be hearing from about 19 others. So I'll go quickly. There's been some good points made already, but I wanted to just touch on a couple and then pass to my left and right, and then we can take questions all together. But first of all, we are here in opposition to Senate Bill 460, and really from AHIP's perspective, and you will hear from some of our Oregon members following me, but from our perspective, it's for two big reasons. Number one, it's the cost implications that were just mentioned, but even more importantly, the fact that it's premature for Oregon to act until the FDA rules on biosimilar drugs. So we keep talking about they're moving along, they're getting there, but they aren't there yet. And this message was just enforced rather recently as last Friday. The FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg told the annual meeting of Generic Pharmaceutical Association that the FDA has not received an application for a biosimilar drug. But the agency has received 50 requests for meetings regarding 12 reference products, and those are often costly biological drugs which cheaper biosimilar drugs would compete with. She also said the FDA was working towards finalizing draft guidances to the industry but provided no timeline. Hamburg also took a swipe at efforts from some of the drug makers who raised questions about the safety of biosimilars that eventually hit the market. In quotes, the high standard for approval of biosimilar and interchangeable products mean they will meet the standards of safety, efficiency, and high quality that everyone expects and can count on. Efforts to undermine trust in these products is worrisome and represents a disservice to patients who could benefit from these lower cost treatments. So you're also in the process of seeing a New York Times article and a New York Times editorial that discusses some of the proponents' lobbying efforts across the states. One of the big talking points, they talk about laws that they want to protect patients' safety. And again, I'll just close by saying I think it makes more sense to see what the FDA does before we move forward on this. So respectfully passing to the left, I guess.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Stetcher with Novartis Pharmaceuticals, speaking on behalf of Sandoz. I'm here to provide testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 460. Sandoz is the generic pharmaceuticals division of Novartis. It's the world leader in developing, manufacturing, and distributing biosimilars. Our biosimilar products are approved in over 50 countries and to date have generated more than 50 million patient days experience without any unexpected adverse events. Sandoz is fully committed to driving access to these critical medicines for patients in the United States, just as we have done for patients in many other countries around the world. Biosimilars have been available in Europe and other parts of the world for close to 7 years and have benefited thousands of patients and have resulted in significant cost savings for healthcare systems. It's important to understand that biosimilars will not be approved in the United States until the FDA is satisfied they are safe and effective. There are no unique risks to biosimilars that would require or warrant extra patient protections over and above those protections that are currently in place for small molecule drugs. The FDA standards for biosimilars will be rigorous. The agency has decades of experience approving biological products and will utilize state-of-the-art analytical and clinical tests to ensure that interchangeable biosimilars are safe. Keyword is interchangeable. Only biosimilars products that meet FDA standards for interchangeability will be approved and designated as interchangeable. In addition, state substitution laws already provide a number of safeguards for patients and physicians in pharmacy substitutions. The prescriber can direct the pharmacist to dispense the originator or brand product and not fill the prescription with an interchangeable product. There is no scientific justification for physician notification beyond that required for small molecule generics. Biosimilars hold the promise of improved access for patients due to increased competition and more affordable prices. Enacting legislation that will create unnecessary hurdles for patients and payers without scientific or clinical justification will only create barriers to access for those patients suffering from life-threatening and often chronic debilitating diseases. For all the patients who are struggling to afford their medicines and the payers who are paying much of the costs, including the Oregon Medicaid program, which would save millions of dollars with biosimilars, I urge you to oppose Senate Bill 460. Let me also say I have lived in the state and worked for Novartis for 28 years. And over the last 28 years, I've heard from countless physicians that I called upon when I was a representative and a district manager. And now for the last more than 20 years, I've heard legislators say to me as well, directors of Medicaid, you guys need to start saying yes. Don't only say no. You need to come up with something that helps us save money. And this is just the kind of thing that a state like Oregon embraces. We like generics. We want the access to be increased and the cost to be decreased. And that's what these products would do. And that's, again, why I urge you to say no to Senate Bill 460.
Thank you. Biosimilars will provide greater access, less cost, et cetera. The only thing is you would have to notify the provider.
Precisely. And the more hurdles you put in between a physician writing the prescription and the end result of that, of the pharmacist going back to the physician, any kind of impediment or barrier ultimately will have the physician think twice before they write the prescription for the biosimilar. And that's why it would not save money to increase the notification from the pharmacist to the physician.
Okay. Well, emails are easy to do, but I do want to ask one other question. Did you allude that biosimilars were really not different from generics?
No.
Okay.
While it is the case that biosimilars are only highly similar to the originator product, it's also the case that originators, too, vary from batch to batch. From Novartis's years of research, we can tell you that a batch of currently marketed biological medication will deviate from the original medicine approved by the FDA. That's the nature of biologics. We also have evidence of major deviations that major products have gone through. However, the FDA has very strong processes in place to evaluate if these deviations impact potency, safety, or efficacy of the product. These products will only be approved if they can be proven analytically and clinically to be, and this is the key phrase, have no clinically meaningful difference.
I think it would be logical that there would be, because biologics are so, they're not exactly like generics, and it's logical that there could be differences in state standards governing pharmacy substitution just because they're not exact, they can't be substituted they're not exactly like a generic.
They will have a higher standard than chemical generics will have. An interchangeable biosimilar will have a higher standard.
Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, what you just said, I'm a simple guy.
Okay.
But what you just said sounded to me like an argument for notifying or letting the patient and the doctor know because of the complexity of these and how they do change from batch to batch. You're obviously talking about a biosimilar that's a generic versus the actual product, but that argument to me sounded more like it would lean toward a situation where it would be good for the doctor to know that a substitution had been made. You have a response to that? I mean, am I getting that wrong?
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, it is true that the FDA will be ruling on this very shortly. It will be a long time until there are actually biosimilars available here in the United States. We're not that close. And as Elise read, the commissioner herself said there's no reason to do this, other than if you want to put impediments to having interchangeable biosimilars available and access the medication and save money.
Madam Chair, are there biosimilars in other markets other than the U.S. market?
Yeah, there are 50 countries that have biosimilars that are available. Novartis Sandoz, our generic firm, makes them.
For other markets?
Yes, 50 other countries.
All right, so you guys are already distributing?
Yes.
All right. So, Madam Chair,
50 million patient days.
So plus. It's only, I mean, in your estimation, then it's only a matter of time. It's coming.
Well, there's going to be, the FDA is rigorous, and there's no reason to have a second evaluation here in Oregon to second guess what the FDA, these folks are experts, they've dedicated their lives to it. As many have said before me and probably many will say after me, they're not going to approve anything that's unsafe.
Madam Chair, if I might continue. So what's the additional layer? Oregon isn't approving these.
There's an extra speed bump or barrier, an extra hurdle in Oregon with physician notification. That would be the extra
okay.
layer.
Okay, all right. So you don't think that it's important for the physician to be notified with these drugs?
We think that the physician already has the ability to write dispenses written. The FDA will have already approved these as interchangeable. Patients will have gotten better for less money in 50 countries and over 50 million patient days in Europe. So we think that that's enough.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Carol Chalka, and I'm with the Oregon chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, representing more than 7,600 individuals in Oregon who live with MS. The National MS Society is officially neutral on this bill, but I want to let you know that the issue is of utmost importance to us. Drugs to treat MS are extremely expensive. They can cost over $5,000 a month. So we're extremely excited by the prospect of biosimilars to bring competition to the market and bring down costs. However, we urge caution before moving forward in developing state policy regarding biosimilars and automatic substitution. Patient safety must be the primary concern. The National MS Society supports current legislative language following the FDA's determination of interchangeability. However, we believe additional time is needed by the FDA, by patient groups, physician groups, and state legislatures to fully understand biosimilars, the interchangeability standards, and the best recommendations for physician notification before developing state law around biosimilar substitution. Existing biologic medications are complex drugs, and we know that not all of the current MS treatments work for every person living with MS. The same will likely be true of biosimilar products. Therefore, we urge caution and allow us to get a better understanding of what biosimilars mean for people living with MS before moving forward. Thank you for considering our perspective.
Thank you. Very much. And I think it's interesting that Janet Woodcock, again, I think Tina Kotek, the speaker, said this, that the director of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research said in an interview that the FDA plans to approve initial biosimilars without issuing the product-specific guidelines. So I know that that is coming, but they won't have the extensive guidelines that I think that the other opponents are wanting think that we should have. All right. Thank you so
Madam
much.
Chair, I have a question before they leave. Elise, you're representing the insurance companies on this?
Yes.
So there isn't a process in place right now for physician notification on other drugs, and that's your biggest concern? Because you talked about cost implications, so I assume the cost implication is somewhere in that process. Am I on the right track? Or
you are, and okay. Madam Chair, Senator Canope, I'd feel more comfortable having one of my member plans who will be following me in this round of testimony answer that question for you.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you.
Okay, well, we only have three more on the sign-up sheet. That's David Barrows from Providence.
No, David Roberts.
I'm sorry.
Oh, David Barrows.
David Roberts from Providence. Betsy Earls and Lisa Tressel.
I just saw David
me,
and
Chair.
I assumed it was David.
That would have been my father's hope.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is David Robertson. I am a licensed pharmacist in the state of Oregon. I am senior pharmacy manager with Providence Health Plans. And in my capacity at Providence, I am a co-chair of our Providence-wide system formulary council. I'm also a leader of our evidence-based medicine evaluation team that supports and provides information to our Oregon Region Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, which is a medical staff committee composed of 26 physicians and practicing pharmacists within the Providence region in Oregon that decides medication use policy, evaluation, and safety. And you have written testimony has been provided. I would like to thank you on behalf of Providence Health Plan and Providence Health Services to express our opposition and concerns with Senate Bill 460 for the following reasons. And you've heard some of this already. The first concern is that we think it's premature. The FDA has not fully finalized their regulations and guidelines regarding biosimilars and the determinant of interchangeability. And until such time as we have that, we are not sure what that's going to look like. And so we think it's too early to have a law in place that could potentially conflict with or not fully address the concerns that could be possible with the process that ultimately is approved. In addition, we are concerned about the additional regulations outside of the interchangeability provision, in that it will only serve to add administrative burden and not provide any additional safety or protections for patients. And as has been mentioned before, the cost of these agents are very, very large in our system. They account for over 20% of our healthcare spend now. And it's very important that for access reasons and for the protection of our patients that we have easy access to the medications that are safe and effective for the treatment of these. So until we have clarity on the process, we urge that this Senate Bill 460 not be passed until such time as we have more understanding of the law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Betsy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has approximately 1,900 members across the state and actually in some other states, too, who are doing business here. And those are mainly companies that would qualify in Oregon as small employers. So although most of them are 25 or fewer or 50 and fewer employees, they are also, for the most part, trying to provide some form of health insurance coverage to their workers. These companies support legislation that helps to control cost and increase access to care. Biosimilars hold the promise of saving consumers and purchasers a great deal of money in the future, And we think that at this point it is premature for the state to impose any additional administrative burden on the prescribing of these drugs in favor of waiting until the FDA issues its final guidance to have a look at what will be most appropriate. And therefore, we urge your opposition of Senate Bill 460.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am so sorry to be here testifying against one of your bills. But my name is Lisa Trussell, and I work for HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. And we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 460. And most of the reasons have been identified, but a key indicator for us is it's the cost. And then the fact that there's, it's more cumbersome. You're putting restrictions on the issuance of the biosimilars that the FDA, with their scientific experiences, are comfortable with sending to market. Specialty drugs in our industry have about a 17.4% trend. And some of that's led because of there's an 11.5% unit cost growth on that. But in that specialty category, as previous people have testified to, biologics are in that capacity. And so, again, one of the things is it's premature. The feds have not approved any of these yet. And we just think that with the cost, Senator Knope had asked a question earlier. Well, part of it is that notification piece. If, not saying I'm lazy or anything, but if I'm a pharmacist and somebody comes in and I could do the substitution if I had the biosimilar, but that would require a phone call, email, or fax, it might just be just as easy to send out the biologic as to do the biosimilar. So I think that that's an element that is of concern.
Thank you very much. All right, well.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry to delay things, but I got
it. No, that's okay.
Okay. So, Lisa, for me personally, or if it was my family, I would want, with these complicated drugs, I would want there to be not doctor permission, but notification to a doctor that, in fact, there had been a change made. So, with that understanding, does that not happen today in any other form for any other drugs? So, are we creating a new system?
Mm-hmm. Well, as Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Knope, according to the notes I received from our pharmacy people that reviewed the bill, this is a level of notification that is a new burdensome to both pharmacies and prescribers. I'd have to go back and ask if there's any others. I know that there is something called dispenses written,
right,
or do not substitute. And so in those cases, they go with that, but I'm not aware that if they haven't checked one of those boxes and a generic, for example, is distributed, that the doctor gets a call.
Well, yeah, and I don't think we're suggesting a call, but so.
Or a note, an email.
Maybe, okay, so maybe I'm not up to speed on electronic records, but if there's a medication being dispensed, does that not go in the patient's mm-hmm. electronic record?
Can I help with that one?
Yeah. Please do.
I can't speak generically for every single different electronic health record system, but the way it works right now, if I prescribe a medication, even if I prescribe it, I'm going to take thyroid medication because that's one that everybody's familiar with. If I were to prescribe brand name Synthroid and didn't check the dispenses written box in my electronic health record, then the pharmacist could prescribe generic levothyroxine without notifying me. That's the law of the land, basically. And even if it was listed in my medical record as Synthroid, they might actually be getting levothyroxine, and that would be completely legitimate legal. The pharmacy does not communicate back to me what they dispense, and they have no obligation to do that. So whatever I wrote is what's in there, although realistically most electronic health records right now make the transition from brand name to generic when they write the prescription. Mm-hmm. So unless I check that dispenses written box, It's going to go through as a generic. It's going to go through as levothyroxine, whether I type in Synthroid into the order box or I type in levothyroxine into the order box. And it's a one-way street. I send it off by e-prescribing to my pharmacy. They get it, and I never hear about it again unless there's a problem.
I get the part.
Is that a fair statement? Does anybody disagree with what I just said? Okay.
So I get the part that there's no obligation. My question is there an ability for them to
The only
get
way they can do it is
you.
Pick up the phone and call me or send me. They can't send me an email because there's no secure system for doing that, and it wouldn't end up in the patient's electronic health record. Then it would just end up in my email. They aren't privy to the patient's electronic health record unless it's a closed system like Kaiser, which is a different issue altogether. But I work at OHSU, where I send prescriptions to pharmacies sometimes all over the state in every different system you can think of, and to mail order pharmacies all over the country. So no, there's no confirmed way, there's no standard way other than picking up the phone and calling me and leaving a message with me or having my MA pull me out of an exam room to let me know that they've prescribed something different. And I don't know anybody who has asked for that. I'm not saying that's true, that how I'm quite decided how I feel about this whole biosimilars issue, but just speaking about what our current practice is with generic medications, that's our current practice with generic medications.
So what I would like, since there's no one else signed up to testify, sort of a cost analysis from the proponents of the bill, that's one thing. They say they just don't want it to be, so it'd be sort of nice to get some numbers on how much this would really cost. And also, regarding the prematurity cost, and I think, Dr. Felix, can you just address the premature? Because I keep thinking of that MS patient who's paying $5,000 a month, and the biosimilar comes, and they could pay $1,000 a month instead of $5,000. To me, that's significant.
Right, and I think we all agree. We are focused on this discussion today because we all want to lower our health care costs. We all want to increase access. That's what these medications are developed for. That's why we have a federal law that gives the FDA the ability to approve these products. What I did hear a few times is this concept of it's too soon. Shouldn't be thinking about it now. We don't have any approved at this time. And I will urge you that the time to have legislation in place is not after a product is on the market. It is before the product is on the market, because what we believe and what many physician groups who've weighed in believe is that in the absence of state-level implementation provisions for biosimilars and biologic medicines, there is confusion. People wouldn't really know how. The pharmacy, the physician, the patient really don't know how this medication would be appropriately utilized. As is very clear, the federal law has detailed, and I wanted to get back to this because somebody had actually mentioned that somehow the state bill does not comport with the federal law, and that is not true. That is clearly not true. The interchangeability designation that is detailed in the federal law gives the ability for a pharmacist to automatically substitute at the retail pharmacy setting without consent of the physician. That is clear, and then it's based on three criteria that are set out in the federal law. So it has to be a biosimilar for one, and you have to show that biosimilar, and this is the part that's being discussed in terms of clinical trial data, is that this biosimilar has to prove that it shall have the same expected clinical result in any given patient. And then lastly, that the risk of switching between the biosimilar and the reference product, the original product, should be no greater than if you were to continue on the reference product alone. So this is already clearly detailed by the federal law, and it is something that the FDA will navigate in terms of approvals. It's already set. So when we hear that there's more information that needs to come out, there are three draft guidances that were released last year. The federal law also states that the FDA does not need to release guidances to start to approve biosimilars. It's very clear.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is not a question specifically. I have to make a comment. You know, I'm a physician, so I have more than my fair share of familiarity with questions like this. And I don't confuse very easily. I have never been so confused and I've sat in hearings in this room long before I was a legislator, I have never been so confused as I am about this bill. I'm hearing on the one hand that we've got a huge safety risk coming, and on the other hand that these are perfectly safe. I'm hearing on the one hand that they're going to be coming out any moment now, on the other hand it may be years. I'm hearing on the one hand that doctors want this, and on the other hand that doctors don't want this. I'm sorry. I mean, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm not paying adequate attention, but I really have been listening carefully, although I was out of the room for a couple minutes. But
you did miss the first part of the testimony.
Yeah, but okay.
In favor.
But still, I heard other ones in favor of it, too. Yeah. So I'm really confused. And I'm not asking necessarily for a response. I'm just being honest with you, Madam Chair, and with other members of the committee. I don't confuse this easy very often, and I'm really confused.
Can I respond?
Sure, please.
There were a number of speakers who we agree with. I mean, when the FDA has spent the time to approve as a biosimilar, you should understand that they've done due diligence. What we're not contesting the concept that these are less safe. I mean, these are to be understood as safe and effective when they're approved. If they're interchangeable, they are to be safe and effective for substitution at the retail pharmacy setting. What we are talking about in terms of complexity of biologics is because of the class of agents. It's not specific to biosimilars. We're not disparaging them. We have plenty of case studies related to biologics that tell us that after the point of approval, there's a lot of things. I mean, you shake these things too much, you put them out in the, you know, on the dock as they're, you know, in on a summer day, the stability changes, proteins aggregate. So we're not saying anything specifically in terms of the safety of these products as they are in terms of biosimilars. We're saying as a class of agents, they are sensitive to handling and to process changes and many other things. So to give this class of agents the correct accommodation to ensure that we're trying to lower costs effectively and with the right provisions in place, we're saying a physician notification makes sense.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I may. Okay, I'm going to be very clear, and this is not private knowledge because I've been in the Oregonian about this. I'm an MS patient, and I get a biologic. I will spend tomorrow afternoon at OHSU getting thousands of dollars worth of monoclonal antibody infused into me. All right, and so I get it. And that's not really affecting my perspective on this, but it does give me some personal awareness. They won't mix that drug until I come in and answer all the questions that I'm supposed to answer to make sure it's safe to give it to me every time because of exactly the issues that you talk about. But the issue of stability of the medication has nothing to do with whether it's a biosimilar or the brand name product. It's equally true for brand name natalizumab, Tysabri, which is what I get, as it is for any other drug that might be approved by the FDA. So why, I'm a little puzzled as to why you'd bring that up as part of your argument against this bill. I'm playing devil's advocate to some extent. As I said, I really don't know where I stand on this at this point. But I'm really, I don't know why you brought that up.
Which part up?
The part about the shelf, the stability of these medications, because it's equally true for the current products as it would be for anything down the road. So we don't notify doctors now about, oh, we're confident that your medication was stored exactly the right way.
No, but if there was an issue with that medication, the physician goes directly to the medical record to understand what the issue was. And whatever's in the patient's medical record will be what the physician either manages their patient with an understanding of or reports an adverse event directly related to the product that they prescribed.
The same thing with the...
Yeah, but I don't generally, I mean...
Can I also add, can I add one more thing in? Just because
sure.
I think, so in the setting that you receive natalizumab in, which is an infusion clinic, this would not affect the clinic that you're talking about. There's already a system in place where, you know, somehow if there was a biosimilar of natalizumab, your patient record would be updated because it's all within a system. We're specifically talking about substitution at a retail setting.
I don't care about me. I'm only talking. I don't care about where it would happen.
Yeah.
All right. That's not the only reason I brought it up is to say I really do have more familiarity with this issue than the average family physician because I deal with these kinds of drugs. I mean, I deal with my patients too, but I deal with them personally. So that's the only reason I was saying that. I don't want to get into a grumpy match with you about this. I'm just saying that you're saying stuff that doesn't. I don't feel like you're answering my questions very clearly, and I think the things you're saying don't really speak to the core issue here or what I think I'm trying to understand is the core issue. I mean, And I don't really think that it's probably worth the committee's time for us to go into this further. We're not having a work session on this today.
Oh, no, no. This
we're nowhere close to doing that. So I think I would
have another
like to
bill.
Leave it be.
So.
We've got another bill, but I'm just.
One last question?
Yes.
Thank you. So if we're only talking about it in a retail setting, how many biologics or what percent of biologics are dispensed in a retail setting?
I actually don't have the numbers for Oregon, but I. For other states, it has been an average of 1.3 to 1.4 prescriptions per week per retail setting. That's the burden that we're talking about at this time.
It would be interesting to get a percentage on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so
that'd be very interesting.
Stakeholders, we would like to have some more information on the numbers that we're really talking about. And of course, and I think that's...
That sounds like a really small percentage.
It's a very small percentage, absolutely.
Madam Chair, just one more comment. It's taken almost a whole month of the legislative session, but you were finally able to confuse Senator Steinmeier. Gotta have some levity, guys.
All right. Thank you so much for coming. I'm going to close the public hearing. This is not the end of this discussion. We will continue this because I am very interested in this bill, and we'll just see what we can do with it. All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 460 and open a public hearing on 470. Senator Cruz, and I don't have the sheet. And Tom Burns and Rob Obey.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
And colleagues, I'm only going to till 5 o'clock today. We have to stop. And so I'm going to carry this bill over to Monday.
For just a work session?
For public hearing, because I know we're not going to be able to get through everything.
Oh,
so if you can't
okay.
get through all of your testimony.
Okay.
Yeah, is there someone who's testifying on this that will not be able to come? Okay, so Senator Cruz, why don't you start us off?
Madam Chair. Okay. Yeah, I have a meeting with Senator Rosenbaum. I think I'm going to have to.
That's fine. This will continue.
I apologize.
Okay.
Shall I start?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I knew as soon as I got down here, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Yeah, well, my caucus leader wants me, so I don't have much choice in the matter.
Okay, for the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, obviously from the best Senate district in the state because it is Senate District number one. So. It's fact. Madam Chair, thank you for the hearing on this bill. This is an issue we have been dealing with in Oregon for close to a decade now, and that is our prescription drug monitoring program. Madam Chair, you and I have spent a lot of time in this building trying to expand access to health care and dealing with issues like patient safety. And in that light, we created the Patient Safety Commission, we have the Pain Commission, and we have a whole lot of different organizations we put in place to ensure not only that we can have good access to health care, but everything we can do to make sure that the people receiving that health care are receiving it in a safe fashion. And that's really the crux of this program we have now, the prescription drug monitoring program, to make sure that providers do have a way of being able to tell what sort of drugs that their patients are getting. Because as we know, a whole lot of people have multiple providers and they don't necessarily talk to each other. So we now have a system that does that. The system is up and running. And like with most new children, they have stumbling blocks. And so we came, and I'm not blaming you, Tom. So we came together to look at our system and what sort of fine-tuning we could do without really changing the whole thing, but just make it potentially work better. And that is why you have before you Senate Bill 470, which the initial bill basically it does really just two things in the major bill that are of major significance. One, it kind of gives more detail into the front-end information, because we were finding that with what we were collecting, you might not necessarily be able to actually identify the real person, because amazingly enough, in the state, even as small as Oregon, there are people with similar names. So we dug a little deeper to make sure that the information that's collected for Senator Canope is actually the information for Senator Canope, not the Senator Canope who lives in Port Orford. And I'll introduce you to him sometime, Senator. That was the one issue in the main bill. The other issue in the main bill was what we have discovered is it's really hard for doctors to actually have the time to input the data. And in fact, in some cases, maybe the doctors weren't actually doing it, but somebody else was. So we wanted to have a very clear pathway to have some for the doctor to be able to assign somebody in his office to have the responsibility and authority to input the data in the system, because quite honestly, the doctors don't have. And we are very clear in this that the line of liability still rests with the person with the DEA license, and it also there's liability for the person who's inputting the data. So we aren't relieving any liability. We're actually adding another piece of liability to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure this data is secure. I think that's the main bill. We have three proposed amendments, and I think I would prefer...
Before we go into that, and be even before your testimony, because there are two people that can't come back on Monday, I would like to have their testimony first. Okay, and I think all I have on here, is it Sue Stein?
Sue, yeah.
Yeah, Sue, do you want to give your testimony now, even though we don't have the layout of the bill?
I can't be back Monday.
And Rob, so let's have Rob and Sue Stein. And what about Corey Hout?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We'll be quick.
Okay. For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rob Ovette, District Attorney from Lincoln County. I'm here wearing a number of hats, primarily as the initial drafter and crafter of what is now the Oregon Prescription Drug Monitoring Program legislation. Fought through that legislation for four legislative sessions, 2003, 5, 7, and 9. We finally got it done in 9. I am the first to admit that what is in that bill, even though I wrote it, has a lot of little quirks that need to be fixed. This bill and the DASH amendments are about fixing some of those quirks. I also need to tell you, as a matter of just historical reference, that unlike a lot of other states, we specifically crafted our PDMP to not be a law enforcement tool. We are after the prevention effect, empowering doctors to look at data to make sure that their patients are not being cross-wired with prescription drugs that are contraindicated with each other or doctor shopping and prescription drug abusing. It is a prevention tool, but it's a tool that is only as good as it's actually used. And as one of the primary people that go around the state giving presentations about drug abuse in Oregon, particularly to pharmacists and doctors, I get a lot of feedback on our PDMP, and boy, have I got a lot of feedback in the last 2.5 years. They've told me a lot of things they want fixed. A Senate Bill 470 fixes straight up a few of the things that I've listed on the back of my written testimony, about six points, actually, that circle around what Senator Cruz already mentioned. The Dash 1, Dash 3, and Dash 7 amendments also clean up some other issues. Now, I wish I could come back Monday. Unfortunately, I'm stuck in trial, available at any of the other days if it, for whatever reason, gets carried over for an additional day. I've already seen some of the opposition testimony. I have some real struggles with some of the things that are said because they don't represent what's in the bill, they don't represent what's in the legislation, and they don't correctly represent what these proposed amendments do. I know we're on stress for time, so I won't go through all the amendments. My summary provides the basis for what those amendments are truly about, which is basically improving the tool, the prevention tool, and its effect to make it more usable and more valuable for our prescribers and our pharmacists. And with that, I think I'll conclude and just just let you know, just I think it's just one final comment. As evidence that this is, in fact, unlike many other states that operate their PDMP as a law enforcement tool, we've had tens of, and Tom can quote you the exact figure on Monday, we've had tens of thousands of hits, uses of our PDMP by pharmacists and physicians. We set such a high standard, the highest in the nation, for access for law enforcement that we've only had two hits from law enforcement, state and local, and one from the feds. There's another big beef between the state and feds about the standard of access, but three total accesses compares to tens of thousands of hits by doctors and pharmacists using the PDMP for what it's designed to be used for, a prevention tool. I don't need more business. I really don't need more business. This is about prevention. This is about reducing the amount of Oregonians who are getting hooked on prescription drugs and providing doctors with powerful tools to help avoid those tragic results that I see played out every day with families and lives in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, the Senate Task Force and Committee. I greatly appreciate you giving us the opportunity to testify today and not carrying over to Monday. I'm actually in surgery Monday, so that would have been a little complicated for me, so thank you for your time. My name is Susan Stein. I am the Dean at Pacific University School of Pharmacy. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm coming to you on behalf of Oregon Society of Health Systems Pharmacists, and I'm here to express support for Senate Bill 470's amendments, as described by Rob Bovet. I will keep it very short. I appreciate and support everything that Rob stated. You have written testimony from our organizations that you can read as well. I think the thing I feel most passionately about, especially being in education, working with soon-to-be pharmacists, is the beauty of these amendments is it really focuses on achieving patient safety. We get the comprehensive list of medications of what these individuals are taking so that we can get them the best possible care we can. We all appreciate the patients having privacy and appropriate information being held as it should with healthcare providers. We all abide by HIPAA, but we want them to have the best care we can. And we are, as Rob has stated, we really are becoming a state leader in this. And the other thing I think that is very apropos is I'm sure you're aware of medication reconciliation requirements from the federal government. This makes it so much easier to do that. And again, the intent is to get our patients to take the medications that are initially prescribed and to help them get the best care they can. One more statement I have on behalf of OSHP, Oregon Society of Health Systems Pharmacists, is they would like to see all prescription medications included. Again, going back to medication reconciliation.
Even biosimilars?
We could talk about that all day long. I was actually on a committee at the United States Pharmacopeia, so I would be happy to chat with you about that offline. Everything. That's the best way for us to help our patients and to help our health system. Thank you so very much. And again, I apologize for not being here on Monday.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. That was excellent. I'll just highlight a couple more points.
And say your name for the
record. Yes, I will. My name is Corey Hewitt. I'm the Director of Pharmacy at Legacy Meridian Park Hospital up in Tooele, and I'm also the Chairman of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. I'm here representing the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. Thanks for letting me testify. Just to add to that, I just really think in the spirit of transformation and healthcare reform, having an accurate database of really what gets filled in the community, we know that physicians write a lot of prescriptions, right? We also know that about 50% of them get filled. And in the spirit of medication reconciliation, have an accurate record. We would really like, with the electronic access records, that we would like to reconcile what's really being filled and the data that's there and the prescriptions and the number of days supply that's being filled in those pharmacies that are dumping into this database. It'd be very helpful for providers such as us in the hospital and or in a clinic setting to assess those patients and make sure that you know, they're just getting the appropriate medications. The one other thing that I'd like to do is the inclusion of the amendments to the other state providers to be to dump in. I'm very involved with HealthShare in the Portland area. Obviously, we have Clark County Legacies involved. We have hospitals in Vancouver. If they could provide data to this, it would be also very helpful. I have no other statements. I just wanted to open up for questions if you guys have any.
I just want to say on that last one, it gave me some pause when we first brought it up because interstate stuff is a little scary and it is a whole other process, but we were making it very clear that it is only Oregon patients that may be seeing providers in Washington or Idaho or wherever, and that the Oregon Health Authority, in this case Tom Burns, is going to write some pretty tight protocols around that, just to make sure that it's still within the scope of this program.
And if I might add, Senator Cruz, if it's okay, just real quickly, while interconnection is a goal, I think, of many of these programs, we're not ready for that yet.
No.
And
no,
so
no.
All we're proposing now, because what I heard from a lot of Vancouver docs is, you know, I'm treating your Oregonians. They're going to fill those prescriptions in Portland. I can't access your database. That's ridiculous. And I said, you're right, that's ridiculous. So our proposed DASH amendment is very narrowly tailored to allow those doctors to access our system based on our rules and comply with our rules so they can look at their own patients.
So they can look at Oregonians that
exactly.
They are treating, pure and simple. So and this is going to be relatively easy to write the rules around this and keep it that tight. So
interconnection is a bigger issue years
yes,
down the road.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I've got a lot of respect for District Attorney Bovet and certainly this topic, and I voted for Senate Bill 355 before, much to the chagrin of a lot of my friends who are members of the ACLU. Where I came from on that is having worked for most of my professional life and people who are in recovery from addiction to kind of set up the structure that would go against enabling them to continue in their addiction. And so I was very much interested in targeting opiates and narcotics and dealing with prescription drug abuse. I wasn't really involved in the intent of that bill, but that's why I voted for it and spoke passionately about it on the floor. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about it that it would eventually become almost an electronic medical record that could help providers. And so can you help me? Is that the direction that we're going in? Is it always been on this path? Or are we tacking? Or where? Because I think I'm a little uncomfortable if we're going to the point of including all prescriptions in this.
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Shields, I think we may be headed there, but this bill doesn't head there, and these DASH amendments don't head there. I mean, we may be in 50 years or maybe less in an entirely electronic world where everything's integrated based on federal rules, but we're just not there. We're not even interconnected yet. So what this is basically doing is making the system functionally more usable and more desirable to use for doctors so they integrate it into their own standard of care for individual health care purposes to get at prescription drug abuse and interactions. So we haven't gone to any of the places they've mentioned, and nor are we proposing to go there. In terms of all the prescription drugs they talk about, we may eventually be there. I'm only proposing that we give the Board of Pharmacy the authority to add additional drugs of abuse. Tramadol is a perfect example. It's I would call it a quasi-opiate, but it's a legend drug, so it's not a scheduled drug. It's something that really should appropriately be in our PDMP for both reasons, for interactions as well as for abuse. And so it feeds right into the context of what we have set up in our own PDMP. So there may be a lot of aspirational goals that a lot of different people have. Frankly, they're not my aspirations, but I'm not a healthcare practitioner. My purpose in getting involved in the PDMP was one of pure drug abuse prevention. That's what I want to see this tool continue to be used for and expanded for, because I believe that if we empower doctors with information, we can actually head off a lot of the tragedy that I see coming into my office 2 or 3 years down the road.
And if I could just follow up, I mean, I'm really comfortable with the idea that pharmacists should be able to talk to the providers and say, hey, did you know that this guy's getting prescriptions in Vancouver, in Tualatin, in Gresham? That's completely comfortable with that, as long as we're limiting the scope and that we're not getting too far beyond that.
And Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Shields, I agree 100% with you. And even though I've fought, for example, the ACLU for 4 legislative sessions, I am probably the only DA who will openly admit that I'm a proud card-carrying member of the Oregon ACLU and support their concerns about security for our PDMP. And we designed our PDMP. We were the 33rd state to actually enact a PDMP, and I think we're one of the last dozen to actually run one up. That gave us the advantage of actually learning a lot of lessons and crafting something that is a very vibrant system and very capable and very secure. And so I support the mission of pure prevention for this program, and that's why we crafted such a high standard for other uses. And I'm not really interested, at least not right now, in expanding its use beyond really what we're doing now, other than, frankly, to make it more easy, more effective, and more powerful a tool for doctors. Because I want to see not just pharmacists looking at it and saying, uh-oh, I want to see, frankly, doctors building it into their own standard of care, their own personal standard of care before they prescribe opiates for chronic non-cancer pain, for example. Well, they just look. And, you know, if this patient that they just look has been seeing 15 other doctors and has all these prescriptions for tramadol and OxyContin and all this other stuff, and they say, oh, I also want to increase their comfort in prescribing opiates, because a lot of folks are seeing, a lot of prescribers are seeing patients for the first or third time or whatever, and they're worried they may create addicts. And if they don't have a tool to check, they can't check. And we have a lot of general practice physicians that are afraid to prescribe opiates when they, in fact, should be prescribing them. So it works both ways.
Madam Chair, I'd also say that when we actually passed this program, we did hear from several folks from pain clinics who basically said, they're afraid to do what they think they want to do because they really can't tell what this person has. So there is some that benefit, I think, is very apparent in this.
Great.
I'm going to want to really scrutinize, make sure I understand the amendments. So if anybody wants to come talk to me and give me their perspective, I'd be
happy. Well, we'll be carrying this over, and we'll be going into detail on the amendments.
Mr. Burns.
And we want ACLU to come up and talk. So. We need to close now, but thank you so much, and thank you for, and I'm glad we were able to get you in. Yes, thank you so much.
Hold on one
yes.
second. I want to suspend the rules so you can vote on the two bills.
Do you want to vote?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Shields to vote on Senate Bill
167
and Senate Bill 548.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended so that Senator Shields can vote on Senate Bill 167 and Senate Bill 548.
That's the wrong one.
548.
Okay.
So Senator Shields on Senate Bill 167.
I want a quick question, Madam Chair. They both passed unanimously. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes, they did.
I vote aye.
Votes aye. And then on Senate Bill 548?
Aye.
Senator Shield votes aye.
Thank you,
all
Madam
right.
Chair.
Seeing no, we're carrying, I've done everything appropriately in carrying this for Senate Bill, carrying the public hearing.
And work session.
And possible work session.
On 470. Okay.
Please. All right. We are going to be carrying over Senate Bill 470 to Monday, and the date on Monday is?
March 4th.
March 4th for a public hearing as well as possible work session. All right. Thank you. Any other? We're adjourned.
Sorry.
Don't.